Black, sitforless.com. This is Film Week On Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So many movies now, from film festivals up to local multiplexes. You know, for example, the Sundance Film Festival, which just a few years ago was getting, you know, several hundred submissions, now is in the thousands of films that are being made. Everybody, it seems, is a director these days. And we see the glut at the box office, where a lot of films are even getting distribution or single screen showings of those movies. But the question is, you know, why are there so many movies? And are there too many movies? In a sense, is it hurting the art form and hurting the business to have such a glut with everybody seemingly able to make a film? We're joined by critics Wade Major of BoxOffice.com and L.A. City Beat, and Andy Klein, who is the film editor of L.A. City Beat. Gentlemen, great to have you with us. Andy, let me start off with you on this subject. You know, every week it seems like the list of films for us to consider gets longer. Why?
Well, I've been tracking this stuff since about 1985, that was my first year as a critic, and I think there were maybe 325 films that showed in L.A., something between 325 and 350. That number has essentially doubled, and most of that doubling, even though it's gone up most years, the last year or two in particular have been brutal. I think a lot of that has to do with the explosion of multiplex screens that are willing to show marginal films. I mean, the simple fact of the Landmark complex in West Los Angeles, and you add to that the fact that the Lemleys have built...
They've expanded a lot.
Yeah. So suddenly you've got all these screens and competition for the really good indie and foreign films, which means that there's some screens that are at the bottom going to get filled with the stuff that was having trouble getting distribution.
Yeah, Wade, what do you think?
I think it has a lot to do with what has transpired since the studios all developed their own independent divisions. And it's ironic as we chose this subject just, I think, within hours of the news that Warner Brothers was killing Picture House and Warner Independent. But it used to be that you had your studio films and then you had your independent films. And when Miramax started making so much money for Disney, all the other studios said, hey, why don't we get us some of that? And they created these independent divisions that really weren't independent. They were meant to either acquire or finance kind of more mid-range films, films that would make big studio money for independent budgets or independent acquisition prices. And, you know, not every movie is David Poland actually pointed this out in a recent column saying, you know, they all want their independent movies to be Junos and Little Miss Sunshines. Well, that's the exception to the rule.
Sure.
More than the rule. The rule is you acquire a film for maybe $1 million, $2 million. Sometimes you'll make one for $5 or $6 million. And if it grosses, you know, $20 million, $25 million, that's a big hit. Bob Burney, you know, the genius of Picture House, who got two Academy Awards this last year out of La Vie en Rose, was just let go, which I find unfathomable. You know, he when he was at Newmarket, he basically turned Whale Rider into an independent success, acquired it for $1 million. It wound up making over $20 million. That's what these companies should be looking at. But those films have kind of fallen onto the bottom end, and now the studios have interjected this whole new mid-range that is really glutting the market.
Andy?
Yeah, well, if you do the math, it's pretty obvious that the box office dollar, at least in terms of admissions, stays relatively stable. The more small films you have out there, they're going to be divvying up what had been the same amount of money, even as production costs digital video may have lowered production costs some, but in general, the tendency is always for production costs to go up. And you've got more candidates dividing up essentially the same sized pie, which means you're going to have more
films that
are going to lose money and more indie distributors falling by the wayside.
That's very true.
Let's invite listeners to take part in the conversation. Do you feel like there are too many films being released, or do you like having more options than you've ever had before what to go see at the movies? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. The gatekeeping process used to be much more severe when you had studios concentrating rating, as Wade and Andy have said, on the bigger, higher budget films. And then you had the independents who would try and get on the very limited number of art house screens around the country, typically only played major American cities or college towns. That has changed dramatically. 866-893-KPCC, also with home video booming and cable and satellite television channels, the desire for films to show has also increased dramatically. So there's a tremendous hunger for product. But, gentlemen, to me, the downside of this is movies that are truly bad aren't very often released. But there are a lot of these mediocrities that have maybe, you know, something a little nice or a nice performance that's okay. You know, we hear the reviews of these every week. These sort of, it's okay kind of thing. And the more people have experiences like that when they've paid money to go to the movie theater, the more it sours them on the experience because it's not compelling enough to necessarily get people out again.
You know, I think that the phenomenon there is a much broader and more complicated one, which is that whereas in the, you know, you go back into the 70s, becoming a filmmaker was kind of something that, you know, it was not really hip. And suddenly all those screenwriting books came out and Spielberg became the superstar filmmaker and George Lucas. And suddenly everybody wants to be a filmmaker. Film schools go from being kind of being in the back room of universities to being the hot property. And now it's like this is the new rock star is to be a filmmaker, to be a screenwriter. And now that you can make your own movie with Final Cut Pro and a video camera and, you know, you don't really have to invest more than a few $1,000s. And that's mostly what gets submitted to Sundance and a lot of festivals these days. It's now anybody. It used to be anybody can write the great American novel. Now anybody can try their hand at making the great American movie. But how many of them are the great American movie? A very, very small
Sundance
percentage.
To me is a great example. They get these thousands of submissions of which they take a small fraction. And then of all the movies that Sundance shows, there's some good ones, some interesting ones, but a lot of mediocrity, a lot of just stuff that's filling screen time.
And frankly, just the explosion of festivals is another factor that suddenly Sundance was sort of the beginning of a real growth of festivals in America. You know, I mean, how many regional festivals do we have in Los Angeles County? You know, there's Malibu, there's Beverly Hills, there's Santa. Everybody's got a little festival.
Right, and every ethnicity and subgroup.
And so everything ends up, every film practically that plays on one screen at the Sunset 5 can tell you that they won the audience award at, you know, the festival
in your garage.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Larry, I think part of the problem, too, is that the people who really have taste, who have judgment for the material, they're all getting let go. Bob Burney just got let go. We said that just a second ago. Paramount Classics under Ruth Vitale and David Dinerstein was, you know, they had their hands tied behind their backs and still did a really amazing job. A better job, frankly, than what Paramount Vantage has done with you know, this bloated overhead. And yet they were let go. Mark Gill, when he was brought on at Warner Independent, this is the man who basically helped build Miramax. And he had both hands tied behind his back. I mean, these are quality executives, and yet the studios are not willing to give them the freedom they need to have to be what they need to be.
When you say their hands tied behind their backs, what do you mean by that? The big studios looking at script approval, budget controls, what?
Too much corporate oversight. A corporate culture that does not understand that an independent division needs to be run by somebody who has freedom and latitude to make creative choices. And, I mean, for good examples, look at Peter Rice at Fox Searchlight. That's a dream situation, and Peter Rice is an amazing guy, and Fox understands how to let him have free reign over the company. Daniel Batzik at Miramax, same thing. You know, those are two guys that really have the freedom to do what they need to do. And those are the examples. But, you know, how Warner Brothers in their announcement can say we're going to let these divisions go, but we're still going to be a home for independent film and for emerging talent, I think that's just really disingenuous.
Well, it also raises the issue of whether the factory setting, for lack of a better term, of a big studio is really the best way to make money. I mean, you have to obviously have it if you're making a big budget film. You need all that overhead to do it. But, you know, look at Pixar's success in animation, for example, as a company that went its own way and how much it outperformed Disney because of that level of autonomy that it had.
Well, that brings up another issue that may verge on conspiracy theory. But, you know, you've got these studio execs who are humiliated come awards time by the fact that the little independent division, you know, I mean, I forget, was there a year when Warner Independent got more nominations than Warner. Certainly Disney never could match Miramax itself. And the people, even though it's the same corporation and it's their money, you have executives towards the top at Disney who were probably looking going, we look like chumps because these guys who we're giving free rein to are getting all the nominations.
But they're not making money. I mean, they're not making films to win awards. Aren't they making movies to make money?
The people themselves, there's this, you know, you're at your party at Beverly Hills and, you know, who's getting more respect? I mean, I'm not talking about the corporation as a corporation.
Yeah, you're talking about the
individual
people.
Execs.
Okay. I think Warner Brothers, without Clint Eastwood, would be a very, very sorry studio in terms of awards. But Warner Brothers, is, again, not to pick on them too much, but, you know, they have over the last 20 years made more movies than any other studio by far. They were the last to develop an independent division begrudgingly, and they're now the first to kill it. I think that tells us everything we need to know.
Which is funny because Alan Horn came from an independent years ago, Embassy Pictures,
yeah.
which was one of the little ones doing offbeat yeah. kind of stuff, and that's the world that he comes from. Norman Lear before that. Roy in Newport Beach, welcome to Air Talk. Your thought of the glut of films. Roy, you there? Nope. Okay, let's talk with Michael in North Hollywood. You're on Air Talk.
Hello, are you there?
Yes, Michael, go right ahead.
You know, I just don't ever think there's a glut of films. You know, we have a ton of films, but you're always going to have great films like Once. Once was probably one of my favorite films, made for a couple hundred thousand dollars with crazy people with some video cameras. And as long as you have that, you're always going to get something. And even if you have to throw it on the internet, you always have fans. To me, filmmaking is about people having dreams, and it's not about the money. Because you can get some video cameras and make interesting films, like even still on film, like Primer, I'm sorry,
yeah.
Which was fantastic. Didn't make any money, but it just has a heartfelt place in my heart for that film.
So you see no problem with the abundance of films because it increases the odds, as you see it, that there'll be little gems coming out.
Exactly, because I mean. Through all of it, through the grist mill, you will find these films that are just fantastic.
Sure. Yeah, Andy? Yeah.
I mean, Primer is exactly the example I had ready to bring up. You've stolen my thunder. And that's a great example. But the problem is that you get one of those out of 1,000, and that when there's an increase in the number, the fact is that the number of really good things is going to be much – the increase of good things is going to be less than the increase of bad things. And they're all splitting that same pie.
All right. Quick comment on that, Wade?
A quick comment on Once, because that's an excellent example. Once, it was Fox Searchlight. Once was, again, you know, the genius of Peter Rice and the people at Fox Searchlight.
But they acquired it, right?
They acquired it, correct. And they had the good judgment to acquire it. But if Once had sort of fallen by the wayside and been acquired by a much smaller company, it would have been much harder for people to see. The marketing dollars would have been less, and audiences might not have found it, and it might not have won an Oscar.
All right. Wade Major and Andy Klein, our critics, with us to talk about the glut of films. Is it a good thing to have all this choice? Does it allow more gems to be seen? Or does it crowd out other things in the marketplace and lead to moviegoer confusion?
Programming is supported by the Southern California Mercedes-Benz dealers, offering test drives of their M-Class luxury SUV. Online visitors can build their own Benz at mbsocal.com.
It's 19 past 11. Good morning. I'm Deborah Baer in for Hedy Lynn Hurdis. This is 89.3 KPCC. Contribute to KPCC today, and you can help restore forests that have been destroyed by wildfires. Give $10 a month. We'll plant 10 trees to say thank you. The more you give, the more trees we can plant. Contribute online at kpcc.org, and thank you very much. National Guard pilots are training in Ventura County for this year's coming aerial battles against wildfires. Demonstrations Thursday at the Air National Guard Channel Island Station at Point Magoo gave pilots a chance to show their stuff, including some new equipment that will make the C-13 Hercules aircraft more versatile. Mayor Brian Allen told the Ventura Star that the new generation of firefighting equipment should be installed by this fall. The new system has a single 3,400-gallon tank with a nozzle extended out to the left side. Instead of waiting on the ground to pressurize the tank, the new technology will allow in-flight pressurization. This is 89.3 KPCC. I'm Deborah Baer. It's 20 minutes past 11.
California Report stories on 89.3 KPCC are made possible by the Evelyn and Walter Haas Jr. Fund, the AARP and its 3 million California members working to ensure access to affordable, quality health care for all Californians. Online at aarp.org and by OSH, Complete Home and Garden Service to Californians for over 75 years. Ideas, tips, and solutions at osh.com.
This is Air Talk. Larry Mantle with critics Andy Klein and Wade Major. The glut of films. Every week it seems we get more and more. And more mediocrity in the bunch. Your thoughts on whether this is good or bad, more choice, or a detriment to the art of film? 866-893-KPECC. Chris in the Miracle Mile District, you're on Air Talk.
Hi. You know, you were talking about the democratization of the media and the fact that, you know, you're getting a lot more people. It's cheaper to make. More people can make films. And You know, you're correct that it, theoretically, that the more films on the market, there should be a lot more to choose from, and that there should be a lot better films rising to the top. You got a bigger pool, but that's not really happening. And if you look throughout history, you know, it was cheap to get a canvas and some acrylics and make it a piece of art, and just about everybody did it, and you had a lot of great art rising to the top. That's not happening in film. And I think the problem isn't the democratization itself isn't the problem. The problem is what we focus on in our modern filmmaking. We focus on novelty. We focus on special effects. We focus on things that outside of story. And I think that, you know, you get kids coming out of school today, they can make really well polished pieces of works, but they don't understand how to make great stories. And I think that's being lost in modern filmmaking.
Wade?
Amen. Absolutely. I agree 100%. You know, this is the thing that is so hard being a critic, because you know, we are now seeing more movies than we've ever seen before, and it's a smaller percentage of them that really excites us. And it's frustrating, because now it's becoming a chore where it used to actually be a pleasant job.
Right, which is why novelty then gets sort of overrated by us in a certain way, because you see so many things that are exactly cookie-cutter versions of each other.
It's painful.
So something that comes along that's different, even if it's sort of bad, you feel a little more sympathetic to, because at least it's breaking.
Someone's taking some kind of a risk, but you know,
something's authentic. It just as long as it has some authentic emotion to it.
And that, I think, is a great point, Wade, because the problem I have with so many of these films is I feel like either the filmmaker has lived such a limited life that we are seeing a cookie cutter kind of the young filmmaker who's lived in the same bubble, or if it's a novelty, it doesn't feel like a true life experience novelty. It's a created kind of a thing. So the gem, the something that rings true and rings authentic and feels like you have a filmmaker who's really, you know, lived a life, that's what stands out.
But, you know, the studios are all chasing the same market, which is that, you know, 15 to 25-year-old male demographic that they think is so coveted. And, you know, those guys are the ones that are making Grand Theft Auto 4 such a huge seller. That thing made $500 million in 7 days. No movie makes $500 million in 7 days. And no movie is made as cheaply at that level as Grand Theft Auto 4. So let those boys have their video games. Make movies for adults.
All right. Thanks very much, Chris. Appreciate your call. Ernesto in Newport Beach, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, how you doing? I think there's not enough movies out there. And, you know, what is called the glut is really just, you know, studios losing out on profits. I think the more movies that are out there, there's more crews, more people who are learning how to make movies, and more possible diversity of experiences. Most movies are about, you know, suburban white families, and that's not what this country's made about. So more movies is good.
All right. Thanks very much, Ernesto. Tina in Long Beach, you're on Air Talk.
Maybe they should just change the marketing. I don't like those movies made for 15-year-olds. I tend to like the indie movies better. Maybe if they charge smaller prices for the smaller movies, and had a tiered marketing process, they'd have more success that way.
What do you think about that?
Yep.
That's a really tricky door to open.
You know, it works in France. I mean, the bigger films are higher ticketed films, and smaller films are lower ticketed films.
I didn't know that.
There's tiered pricing. Sure.
All right, Tina, thanks. Craig in Emeryville, welcome to Air Talk.
Hi. I'm not sure I'd call it a glut, because I don't know if I really believe in the zero-sum game. I like to keep in mind, you know, Heinlein said 98% of everything is crap, so I live for the other 2%. But I see this a lot, like the days when Macs first came out and everybody had access to a whole bunch of fonts. And there were a few years there in the 80s when everybody's letter looked awful because it had 14 different fonts on it. But eventually, people catch on. The good stuff rises to the top. And I think that movies with real stories are the ones that are going to rise to the top.
All right, Craig, thank you. Vivian in Santa Monica, welcome to Air Talk.
Larry, hi. I just called because I teach film at a local college, and I want to echo what the last couple of callers have been saying, because I see it with young people, with 20-somethings. I teach basically classic Hollywood films, okay? And when we're done, or as the course goes on, these young people all say they've never seen anything like this, because no matter how exotic the locales or that they see up on the screen, they recognize true human behavior. And the other thing, the real payoff is, after the grades are in, I cannot tell you the number of people, of these students, who've said they can't go to movies anymore with their friends because they see them as crap, most of them, and their friends don't get it. I liken it to the expansion of baseball or sports, you know, or hockey. You had six great teams with 100 top players 100 years ago, and now you have how many? And there are, you know, one or two great players, and the rest are kind of mediocre.
Vivian, thanks. Great call.
Yeah.
Andy?
Yeah, there really is, I don't know whether it's Malthusian or Darwinian. I mean, things are going to shake out on their own. The problem is that it's not always clear that that's going to happen in the best possible way, and the Warner Independent thing may be one of those examples.
You know, as angry as the whole Warner thing makes me, because neither of those divisions was ever really given their shot, I think the silver lining in this is that we are seeing now more genuine independents that are not dependent upon the studios. You know, we now have Overture and Summit, both of which are unaligned with studios and which are very, very well bankrolled. I think they have yet to really sort of demonstrate their strength in the market, but they're out there acquiring product. And, you know, there's always Think Film, which is growing at a steady mm-hmm. pace, you know, that was Jeff Sackman and Mark Ehrman, formerly of Lionsgate, which mm-hmm. under Tom Wartenberg is a tremendous yeah. company.
And very independent guys.
And very independent.
Yeah. But won't the same thing happen to them that happened 15, 20 years ago, where you had Miramax, New Line, all those companies, and eventually the studio showed up with these big wads of money?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, Think Film has really those guys left Lionsgate to be independent. I don't think they want to be dependent. And Lionsgate has sort of made it known it wants to play with the big boys and not be acquired by them. You also have Peace Arch. We're going to be talking later about a film being released by Peace Arch this week. Peace Arch is another Canadian company like Lionsgate that's been acquiring a lot and looks to really want to sort of have its own identity in the marketplace.
Let's talk with Bjorn in Canoga Park, our final caller on this topic. Hi, Bjorn.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for bringing up this topic. I'm one of those wannabe filmmakers that your critics are discussing today. As a matter of fact, the LA City Beat did a front cover story on what my film is about. The first anti-war demonstration here in Los Angeles was broken up by the police in 1967 when Lyndon Johnson was here. But my point is this. You know, I've dumped all of my money, all of my savings into a story that probably never would have been told. And through the advent of these digital video cameras and the equipment, we can produce high-quality product at an entry-level price. And these stories wouldn't be told, and you kind of disparage Sundance a little bit. But I've been doing my research on the 2007 Sundance entries, and been renting them through Netflix, and I think there's a great body of work there, Crossing the Line and many others. So the point being is that a lot of these stories would never be told, and I don't think that, you know, these big box office films are great films just because they have box office success. So I think...
All right, Bjorn. Yeah, let me let our critics weigh in on this. Certainly when it comes to documentary films, I would agree with you that the quality is generally higher, but I can't agree with you on the narratives.
It's a double-edged sword because, yes, that makes it possible for good filmmakers to go out and make movies where the resources otherwise would have been prohibitively expensive, but it also enables 10,000 other guys with no talent and an overinflated ego to go out and do the same thing. So the noise, the increase in noise, I think sometimes drowns out the more ready availability of material to talent.
And theoretically, as critics, we're supposed to be kind of the noise filters for people, but or one of the kinds of noise filters. But the fact is that we get overwhelmed, and also we're all being thrown out of work. So.
Which doesn't help. Andy Klein of City Beat and from BoxOffice.com and City Beat Wade, Major Charles Solomon joining us as well, animation critic for Amazon.com. This is Film Week on Air Talk.
Commercial radio is paid for with commercials. Public radio is paid for by the public. That would be you. Public radio thrives only when listeners like you decide to become contributing members. Those individual contributions are the largest source of the money it takes to pay for the high-quality news you hear every day. Become a member now. It takes just a minute or two at kpcc.org. Thanks.
Film Week on Air Talk with a look at the week's new movies, kicking off with Speed Racer, an adaptation of the popular 1960s Japanese cartoon series. The young driver tries to save his family's business from a corrupt corporation. Emil Hirsch, Christina Ricci, and John Goodman star. Film's written and directed by the Wachowski brothers and rated PG. In this scene, Rex, played by Scott Porter, gives young Speed, Nicholas Ilya, a driving lesson.
Feel that shimmy? Your hind legs trying to outrun your front.
What do I do?
Stop steering and start driving. This ain't no dead piece of metal. The car's a living, breathing thing, and she's alive. You can feel her talking to you, telling you what she wants, what she needs. All you gotta do is listen.
Go, Speed Racer, go. What'd you think, Charles?
Well, this is a difficult film to discuss critically because words like visual overkill and wretched excess seem so inadequate in the face of it. This began as a modest little Japanese series, Mach Go Go Go, that was heavily re-edited and put into American TV as Go, you know, Speed Racer, Go Speed Racer. And it's been turned into this bloated mess by the Wachowski brothers. I'll leave the live-action performances for Andy and Wade to thrash out, but everything is done digitally. There are the sets are these bloated, again, masses that look like they were either carved out of Jell-O or shot at Chernobyl. They're so brightly colored and overlit. Speed Racer was originally, you know, the local kid, the small town racer who went up against small town swindlers or crooks or race fixers. Now he's up against the zillion-dollar empire that is apparently headquartered on Coruscant from Star Wars, from the looks of it and the buildings around it. The racing is all CG. There's no stunt driving. There are no real cars. So, and everything is so over-edited and overcut and cut from such weird angles, you have no idea what's going on. These things, you know, cars are jumping over each other and ramming into each other and flipping over and doing 360s and 720s and so on. But you have no idea, is this the beginning of the race, the end of the race, a key point in the race? Who knows?
Well, it's funny because the old Speed Racer cartoons, as I remember, were sort of built around races to settle something. And there, you had the vroom vroom and that. You know, the sort of quaintness of it was part of the fun of the show.
Well, there's no quaintness here except inside the Racer family home where Susan Sarandon, who apparently needs money, is always frying pancakes and serving glasses of cold milk to everyone. And is, you know, makes gentle Ben's family look corrupt.
Speed Racer, Andy.
Yeah. I felt like I was being pummeled for, and let me emphasize this, for 2.25 hours. This is another one of those films that would have been, I'm not saying it would have been good, but it would have been much, much better at 95 minutes or something. In fact,
or five.
There's a huge buildup to this race, which is the qualifying race. And I, you know, it was like 1 hour and 45 minutes in, and I'm thinking, well, how weird that they're going to end with the qualifying race, but that's because they weren't. And then you start all over again and have the build up for the final big Grand Prix
and build the car in 32 hours to that's going to win.
Well, I'll let them be implausible, but I've never seen a film that looked more I mean, even Tron perhaps didn't look as much like a video game as this does.
This makes Tron look like My Dinner with Andre.
But a boom.
Yeah, no, you know, I've nicknamed this Days of Blunder. This is, and I got to say, Emil Hirsch, this is, you know, two films in a row where he's died in a motor vehicle. He needs to do something, I think, a little, just step aside and do something different. It was a good career move probably on paper, but there's no acting in this movie. Being, you know, younger than my colleagues here, I actually was a kid when the show was on the air, and I loved it as a kid. And watching the cartoons again recently, I'm realizing that it's not as good as I remembered, but there was the germ of a really cool soap opera. And what the Wachowskis, or the Wachowskis, if you want to, you know, give it the Polish pronunciation, as a friend of ours keeps reminding us, what they've done is sort of take the cartoon aspects and blow it up big, and then take that germ of a soap opera and just sort of let it dwindle. And it should have been the opposite. You know, they focused on the wrong aspect of the TV show.
And all with enough cutting and special effects to induce epilepsy.
Speed Racer, adaptation of the 60s Japanese cartoon series. The Wachowski brothers, Larry and Andy, wrote and directed it. It's rated PG, and there's also IMAX screenings of the film as well. Oh, so you can really immerse yourself in it.
Imagine it in IMAX.
Yeah, you missed out on your screening, Charles. A Previous Engagement stars Juliet Stevenson, story of a woman who takes a family vacation to Malta but doesn't tell her husband she plans to keep a date with a lover that was made 25 years ago. Joan Carr Wiggin wrote and directed the film. In this scene, Julia, played by Juliet Stevenson, and Alex, played by Cheki Cario, discover neither has come to Malta alone.
You brought your husband!
You brought your girlfriend!
A girlfriend is not as bad as a husband.
She's a young girlfriend. A young girlfriend is worse than an old husband.
No, an old husband is worse than a young girlfriend. How could you bring him with you?
Oh, yeah. What am I supposed to do? Sweetie, I'm just popping over to Malta because I made a pact with a former lover that we were going to meet at the Clarion Cafe 25 years from now. Ciao!
A Previous Engagement. What do you think, Wade?
You know, this is a tough one because I'm one of those who's always harping on the fact that studios and no one makes movies for 50 somethings or for even people in that age group, that there's this giant market that's being underserved. And Joan Carr Wiggin, and who, you know, wrote and directed the film and her husband produced it, they're latecomers to filmmaking, and they specifically wanted to make a movie for people in their age group. And for that, I applaud them. I just wish it were a better movie for people in that age group. But it's hard to be too choosy because there just isn't that much to choose from. But the movie's, it's a little clunky. It's a little sloppy. The jokes kind of come in fits and starts, and the relationships don't quite ring true. The staging is a little bit off. It just feels like something that should have maybe had more time to gestate. But that being said, you know, if you're somebody who's that age and looking for a movie, and the Maltese backdrop is really beautiful to look at, so it's hard to be too critical.
For a while, we had a whole spate of these kinds of, for lack of a better term, Shirley Valentine films,
yeah,
you know,
that, yeah.
And it seems like there's been a dearth of them lately,
really
so
a dearth.
So this comes back to fill
let,
it.
Let me say, as my generation appreciates your solicitation and or solicitousness, and most of those films I hate, even though I'm that generation.
A Previous Engagement, Juliet Stevenson, Cheki Cario, star in a film directed and written by Joan Carr Wiggin. This is Film Week on Air Talk. Our critics have a lot more movies to talk about this week. Next up, Before the Rains, set in South India. This is Film Week on Air Talk.
Programming supported by Jeff Hyatt Termite, offering an orange oil treatment that can control termites without using hybrid chemicals. Orange oil can kill termites on contact. You can call for an inspection at 800-865-2307.
This is 89.3 KPCC. It's 11:39. I'm Deborah Baer. State Schools Chief Jack O'Connell says California is losing teachers to other states. They're being lured by the prospects of more stable jobs in Texas, Kansas, Virginia, and Hawaii. Thousands of California teachers have received pink slips because of the state's budget crisis. Jefferson High School in Los Angeles has a long history of fights between blacks and Latinos. Now, people who want peace are speaking out.
Following a series of racially motivated skirmishes and shootings, Alberto Retana with LA's Community Coalition said it's time for Latinos to say enough.
We feel that Latinos in this city have been quiet and silent on the brown-on-black murders, on the brown-on-brown murders, on the murders in general. And rather than sit back and allow others to talk about it, As activists, we felt we needed to step in and help frame the debate.
Brittana and others offered a litany of solutions to LA's ongoing violence and gang problems, including more money for infrastructure, education, and after-school programs for kids. The activists also urged elected officials to do more to counteract what they called a culture of violence nurtured by poverty and gang culture. Brooke Binkowski, 89.3 KPCC.
Programming is supported by the Wilshire Theater Beverly Hills, presenting Love, Janis, the life and music of Janis Joplin on stage in this new musical. Going behind the music and offering a glimpse at the soul of a legend through letters she wrote and her songs, Me and Bobby McGee and Mercedes-Benz come to life in this intimate portrayal inspired by the book by Laura Joplin. Five performances, May 29th to June 1st at the Wilshire Theater Beverly Hills.
Film Week on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Charles Solomon, Wade Major, and Andy Klein with us as well. Before the Rain stars Linus Roach and Jennifer Ely in a film directed by Santosh Sivan. It's rated PG-13 and is the story of an English baron played by Linus Roach who settles in South India to open a spice plantation in the 1930s. In this scene, the baron and his servant played by Nandita Das have a private moment.
Madam's things have been unpacked and put away. I also called for the workers to put in the tub.
Sajani.
They'll be here soon.
Sajani.
Will there be anything else, Sahib?
Stop it, please. You've made your point.
What do you want me to do?
I know this isn't easy.
I've risked everything. My honor, my life.
I know.
And what have you risked?
I love you. You know that. I want us to be together more than anything.
Before the Rains is rated PG-13, written by Kathy Rapin and Dan Verite. What'd you think, Andy?
You know, this is very familiar turf. It's the old W. Somerset Maugham kind of story about the colonialists interacting with the natives. I felt like I'd seen it a lot before, and Merchant Ivory at least helped distribute this. I think they picked it up, and it feels like a Merchant Ivory film, and I don't say that in a completely positive way. The only thing I saw different here was that the focus for once is really on the native assistant. I mean, he's really the protagonist, not the Linus Roach rich guy character. And he is really, Linus Roach is almost a plot device to get things to happen to Rahul Bose, I guess is how it's pronounced, who plays the assistant. And he gives a terrific performance, but boy, we've seen this a lot, and it's not in a league with, say, The Letter or Painted Veil.
All right, Before the Rains, Wade.
Yeah, I don't think it's in that league, but I actually quite liked it. Santosh Sivan, who is also his own cinematographer, he started his career as a cinematographer. He's a very gifted filmmaker. He made a film some years ago called The Terrorist, which is on DVD, and I highly recommend it. It's just visually spectacular, and it's just gut-wrenching and very, very timely. This is not as good as that, but it's a well-made film. There is certainly that familiarity aspect to the interracial adulterous affair, and gosh, why don't those ever turn out well, you know?
But the natives are so beautiful. Do you notice?
Yeah. it's nice to see the great cast, really good performances, just beautifully photographed, and for what it is, I think it's probably the only, you know, you're kind of getting an awards level feeling film at a time when people aren't expecting that. So people who are looking for that right now will welcome it.
Before the Rains, rated PG-13, directed by Santosh Sivan, written by Kathy Rapin and Dan Verite. The Babysitters stars John Leguizamo, Catherine Waterston, and Cynthia Nixon. David Ross wrote and directed. The film is rated R. It's the story of a teen who turns her babysitting service into a call girl ring for married family men. Wade?
You know, and that description actually doesn't do it justice. I was telling somebody earlier that this is the kind of film that would have have been kind of a B-grade sexploitation film in 1968 with all kinds of really eye-catching stuff on the poster, really scandalous. But in fact, it's a lot more thoughtful than that. This is being released by a company we mentioned earlier, Peace Arch, one of the new upstart independents. And it's actually several notches above that. The psychological ramifications of these high school girls who are so, you know, who need to make it to college and yet who are kind of calloused and have this amorality and they become addicted to this power structure where it's not even prostitution. It's like it's a way of earning money. It's a legitimate job and you actually have some control over your clients. I thought it was actually very well done for what it is.
Is there humor in it or is it played as drama?
There's some humor, but it's actually very disturbing. It's very unsettling and it's meant to be. And, you know, the rough spot is that John Leguizamo and Cynthia Nixon are not really a good couple. You don't quite buy that. They're different actors and their chemistry never quite meshes, but they do very well independently. And Catherine Waterston is terrific.
The Babysitters is rated R. John Leguizamo, Catherine Waterston, and Cynthia Nixon, written and directed by David Ross. Mr. Lonely is directed by Harmony Korine, who co-wrote the screenplay with Avi Korine. It's the story of a Michael Jackson impersonator who falls for an impersonator of Marilyn Monroe. The Jackson impersonator goes with the Monroe impersonator to live in a commune of impersonators in Scotland. Diego Luna, Samantha Morton, Dennis Levant, and Werner Herzog star in the film that's unrated. Andy?
The first image of this film I absolutely adored, and it got my hopes way up, and then my hopes were dashed. I mean, the first image is just this sort of slow-mo shot of him on a very low bike going past a red and white wall with a toy monkey bouncing off the back of the bike. And it's a completely memorable shot. And then the film kicks in. I couldn't care about these people at all. The Herzog subplot is in no direct way related. Herzog plays a priest who discovers that the nuns he's like a missionary and the nuns on the island he goes to can fly. And that's a very funny, at least at times funny subplot, but I did fail to see the connection, which may be my fault. But basically, this seemed like it was a movie in which a lot of scenes were done as improv by people who aren't very good at doing improv.
Mr. Lonely, Wade.
You know, Harmony Korine is not my favorite filmmaker.
What else has she done?
Yeah. Gummo, Julian Donkey Boy, and then as a screenwriter, Kids and Ken Park for director Larry Clark. I find his stuff very stream of consciousness and in a kind of undisciplined way. But that being said, I think I responded to this better than I've responded to anything that he's done previously. In part, I think because it's so odd. And you know, again, earlier we were talking about films that felt personal and authentic and different. And I think just the fact that this took me places that I've never gone before, and it really does have some very striking imagery. So I feel I can forgive the fact that it ultimately doesn't really go anywhere and doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
You're so much nicer than I am.
It sounds like Jules Pfeiffer's Passionella.
Wow. I can't remember
Sorry.
That's all right. We just need to get your mic on before you talk. Mr. Lonely is the film. Diego Luna, Samantha Morton, Dennis Levant, and Werner Herzog, directed by Harmony Korine, who co-wrote the screenplay with Avi. It's Avi Korine. It's unrated. The Fall is set in Los Angeles early in the 20th century. A bedridden man strikes up a friendship with a young girl in the hospital. Her imagination is ignited with a fantastic tale. Tarsem Singh directed the film and co-wrote the screenplay, which is rated R. Here in this scene, Alexandria, played by Katina Untaru, and Roy, played by Lee Pace, get acquainted in the hospital.
What's in your box?
Things I like.
Things you stole?
No. A photo.
Where'd you get the elephant?
My friend gave it to me at work. He's from India. Look. This is my horse. And this is my father.
Yeah. He's got the same gap in his teeth.
Must run in the family.
Yeah, and here is my house.
Oh, yeah?
It was my house.
What happened?
They burned it.
Who burned it?
Angry people.
The Fall is the film starring young Katina Untaru and Lee Pace. What'd you think, Wade?
You know, it's funny. Andy and I have been talking about this, and I think we were both a lot more down on this film until we saw Speed Racer.
Everything looked better.
And in hindsight, I think it's actually kind of growing on me. It felt very, you know, this film's about a year and a half, 2 years old, actually. And it's not an easy film to sort of wrap yourself around, because Tarsem has this extreme style. And when you go into the storytelling sequences, which are all sort of in the little girl's imagination, it is all of that stuff from the cell, all of those draping tapestries and those exotic headdresses and, you know, masks and the things that are sort of becoming very identified with his style, almost to a negative degree. But at the same time, the little girl in this movie, who I started off not liking, Katinka Untaru, who's Romanian, by the end of the movie, I just fell completely in love with her. There's something so naturalistic about her, mm-hmm. and so incredibly empathetic and honest. And Lee Pace, you know, of television's Pushing Daisies, who was a nobody when he made this movie, the way he interacts with her, it becomes magical at a certain point, and you don't care about the other stuff.
Yeah, apparently they did her scenes more or less as improv, so that you do get this completely natural sense where she's talking over him. They actually rewrote plot elements because of things that she said that weren't what they had intended to be in the scene. I think the visuals are gorgeous. I love it for that. My biggest complaint was that towards the end of the film, when the storytelling, when the Lee Pace character is getting in a bitter mood and he starts making the story be really, really ugly, and the little girl is sitting there crying, and they do this for like 20, 25 minutes of him being torturing the little girl so much that I lost all sympathy for him.
I will say, for a film that is ostensibly aimed at least in part at children, it is terribly, terribly violent.
It's rated R. If it's aimed at kids, it's not going to do.
It should be R.
It should be, but it clearly they were aiming it at children even before they got that rating. That I think may have been a stumbling block.
Tarsem Singh, the director and co-screenwriter Lee Pace and Katina Untaru co-star in The Fall. OSS 117 Cairo, Nest of Spies. A French secret agent fights international crime in the late 1950s. Michel Hazavanicius is the director and co-screenwriter. The film is in French and unrated. Andy.
This is one of the silliest films I've ever seen, and I say that as a totally positive thing. It's a James Bond spoof, essentially, that somehow brings this ironic distance where this guy goes to Egypt, he's French, and he's the most culturally insensitive idiot in the world. He's like if Inspector Clouseau was sort of a closet racist. But he's so sweet and naive that he just doesn't even get it. So you have this ironic distance where we're looking at these events from the perspective we have today, but he's still in that world.
Yes. Wade?
I think this is the funniest spy spoof ever made. And I am not prone to hyperbole. But if you look at the history, if you go all the way back to the Armand Flint films and even Get Smart, Matt Helm, Modesty Blaze, Fathom, Casino Royale, you take all of that stuff, none of it, even Austin Powers, I don't think any of it is as good or as funny as this film. The way that it – and what it does that none of those do, it manages to be broad and yet an homage at the same time. And all of those others had to kind of choose one or the other. Are we going to be silly or are we going to be kind of more faithful? And somehow – and I'm very impressed that you got Hazanavicius' name right, because there were people at Kolkoa who could – French people who couldn't even pronounce that. It manages to replicate almost perfectly the look of those old Sean Connery movies and yet be just blissfully ridiculous.
Oh, this sounds really fun.
It is absolutely
incredible. This is your pick of the week?
Yeah, pick of the week
both
for
of us.
Sure.
I may be going to see it again tonight, frankly.
Well, I'm going to go see this right away. This sounds very fun.
And you know, Jean Dujardin developed he really came of age in France with these little kind of vignette comedy bits in the evening on television. And Hazanavicius is from television as well. And I think they bring bring a certain television, in a good way, they bring a television sensibility to this, and I think it's very refreshing.
The French film OSS 117 Cairo, Nest of Spies, it's unrated. Want to mention there are special events taking place in Southern California related to film, including tonight at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the 12th Mark Davis Celebration of Animation, titled Drawing on the Future, Mentorship in Animation. Our Charles Solomon will be moderating a panel discussion with James Baxter, Andreas Deja, Pete Docter, and Eric Goldberg. It's at the Samuel Goldwyn Theater of the Academy in Beverly Hills. Charles, what are you going to be talking about?
Basically, we've got four of the great young animators of our generation who are going to be talking about how they learned from the works of the nine old men and the previous generation of animators and how they apply their lessons to the new works and showing clips from older movies and their own films.
You're going to have a moment of silence for Frank and Ollie?
We're actually going to dedicate the evening to Ollie's memory as the last of the nine old men who left us just a few weeks ago.
The event's open to the public, I take it?
Yes.
All right. Tickets are nominal, like $5. It's at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences on Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills tonight at 7:30, the 12th Mark Davis Celebration of Animation, Drawing on the Future, Mentorship in Animation, moderated by Charles Solomon. Also want to mention, out on DVDs this week, Bella, directed by Alejandro Gomez Monteverde, starring Eduardo Verastegui, Tammy Blanchard, and Ollie Landry. What'd you think of Bella, Wade?
It's a good little film. This was a kind of a surprise for a lot of people because it didn't get picked up by anybody when it was doing the festival round, and they wound up actually self-distributing it. And I think a lot of people saw Ali Landry on all the talk shows at the time, really pushing it and saying, help us get the word out. So it's kind of one of those self-distributed surprise success stories, and it's nice that it's on DVD.
All right, Teeth, written and directed by Mitchell Lichtenstein, Jess Weixler and John Hensley co-star in the story of a girl who ends up defending herself anatomically. Wade, what do you think?
I think it's a very, very important public service announcement for flossing.
Oh, Wade.
we'll leave it at that.
And from there to P.S. I Love You, Richard LaGravenese, this is a film that's out. Our critics are not going to talk about it today, and I'm sure for very good reason. And Todd Haynes, I'm Not There, which he directed and co-wrote, Christian Bale, Cate Blanchett, Richard Gere, Heath Ledger, and Julianne Moore starring that. Andy?
I liked I'm Not There. I thought it had problems and it was all over the map, but Cate Blanchett's great. And you do get a weird sense of Bob Dylan.
All right. What'd you think, Wade?
I didn't care for it. It annoyed me. I felt it was all over the map and never really kind of came into focus. But again, Todd Haynes is first and foremost an experimental filmmaker.
All right. Thanks for being with us for another Film Week on Air Talk. For our critics, Wade Major of BoxOffice.com and City Beat, Charles Solomon of Amazon.com, and Andy Beat of City Beat. Andy Klein of Andy Beat, City Beat. Thanks for being with us. Our thanks also to our great production team, Linda Othen and Gerard, who's our senior producer, producers Jackie O'Clery, Mindy Steinman, and Chumi Paul. Doug Gary is our director for Air Talk, and we appreciate all their hard work in putting the programs for you together each and every day. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll be speaking more clearly and back with you Monday for the next edition of Air Talk.